First of all, Mr. Rustin, for this record, when and where were you born? And could you trace concisely what you regard as the early influences in your life, family, school, other?
Well, I was born in Winchester, Pennsylvania, which is southeast of Philadelphia by 20 miles. I was reared by my grandmother and grandfather, Julia Davis Rustin, and Jennifer, J-A-N-I-F-E-R, Jennifer Rustin. My mother was Florence Rustin. She was, I believe, about 17 at the time of my birth. And my father, who was not married to her, was a young man around 19. They were both very immature youngsters. They had no way of taking care of me. Consequently, my grandparents, that is my mother's mother and father, took me in. And actually, I must have been maybe 11 years of age or 12 before I knew that my mother was my mother, because being born into a family in which she was the oldest and in which my aunts and one uncle pretty much treated me as a member, as a brother or sister. Until this day, I consider those relatives who are still living my brothers and sisters rather than my aunts and uncles. And consequently, the greatest influence on my life, since my mother soon moved away and actually started another family, I was largely influenced by my grandmother, who was a graduate of the Quaker schools in Westchester, and whose mother had been reared in the Quaker household of the Butler family. And my grandmother was a contemporary with Smedley D. Butler, who was a general in the United States Army, though a Quaker. And it was, I think, my earliest influences were those of the Quakers, the belief in non-injury, non-violence, respect for other people, and the like. I remember on one occasion the community used to do a Christmas service. And at one of these Christmas services, when I must have been around 8, I turned to my grandmother. The whole city turned out for them, Catholic and Protestant. And it was such a popular thing that even though it were a Christmas affair, very often the Jewish members of the community turned out to it. It was a community solidarity kind of thing which took place at Christmas time. To give you some feeling about my grandmother, I nudged at her and I said, "Did you see who just came in?" And she said, "They're quiet now. Who was it?" And I said, "It's John Hopkins." And John Hopkins was a pound drunk. And I said, "I'm really quite shocked to see him come here." And she said to me, "When we get home, we will talk about it." And when I got home, she chastised me, but in a very nice way, by saying, "You must not judge other people, because if, as you say, he is the town drunk and is no good, then it must have taken much more energy for him to have come than it took for us." And I don't know, but somehow that one event seems so typical of her attitude to people and things. I remember on another occasion when she, who had helped found a day nursery for blacks in the town, because everything was segregated except the high school, she had helped set up with Dr. Leslie Pinckney Hill, who was the president of Cheney College, just outside Westchester, a school for blacks that the Quakers had established. Some years later, at the ripe age of 75 or so, some of the city fathers got together and gave her a little celebration. And one of the things that she was asked at that occasion was, "Mrs. Rustin, you worked very hard, you faced a lot of problems, you were one that whenever a child was sick, the parents would come to you and you would see what could be done, and if someone was in jail, they'd come to you, and you saw so much racial discrimination and the like. How is it you never lost your bearing, your dignity?" And she said, "Oh, there are two things. One is, it is just too tiresome to be hateful." And they said, what was the second? And she thought for a moment, and she said, "Oh, I decided long ago that I was not going to let people mistreat me, and in addition, give me indigestion." That was her attitude. I remember once as a kid coming home saying that I lived in a part of town which was near the Catholic Church and near the Italian part of town. And many things, even matters like pizza, which were totally unknown at that time outside the Italian community. It wasn't the kind of pizza we have today. It was a Sicilian pizza, the big, thick, breaded pizza with a little, a considerable amount of cheese and tomato on top and very often other things. And I learned to eat that because my best friend was a kid whose name was Pascal, the bundle, PASCALEDUBUNDO. And Pascal de Bundo lived across the street from us. And for some perfectly and illogical reason, because he never used unkind language, but I made him angry. And I cannot even remember why I made him angry, but I'm sure I must have, because he wouldn't have responded if I hadn't. And he said, acting like a nigger. Well, this struck me as very hard because I was very fond of him. But I came home and I told my grandmother I was not going to eat any supper. And she said, "Well, do you think it's wise?" And I said, "Well, Pascal was treating me so I don't feel like eating." And this shows how practical she was. She said, "Well, now what I'd like you to do is to wait for 15 minutes, because at 6:15, the Debundas will be sitting down to supper. And I would like you to go over and just look in the window." And I went over and I looked in the window and I saw all the Debundas sitting there eating. And when I came back, she says, "Was Pascal eating?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, now, if you think he mistreated you, and you are not going to eat, does that make sense?" And I decided it didn't, and I had my supper. She was a remarkable, remarkable woman. And our house was a big old house. But my grandfather, though poor, got through another Italian family, because he was a caterer and provided meals and banquets and things for people in the country clubs then, and for the very wealthy Ricci family, R-I-C-C-I, which were the makers of ice cream and had a big ice cream company, an ice company in this little town. And they had some, I guess, 10 children, and the house they had was too small, so he rented it to my grandfather. Well, for us, it was a big, big house. It had about 10 rooms, but he could afford more, and he wanted something bigger. And that house became sort of a center of activity in the town. All the young people came because they were made to feel comfortable. And by the time I was, I guess, a freshman in high school, everybody referred to my grandmother as Ma Rustin and my grandfather as Pa Rustin. And it was a hubbub. And the fact that they had a great number of children meant that people were coming and going. One of my early experiences that struck me very deeply was that being on the main line into Philadelphia from the south. At that point, when I was a young boy, the great migration of blacks from the south north was coming. And as you remember, that very often they stopped in Baltimore for a night or two, and then they moved up to Wilmington, Delaware, sometimes even walking 3 or 4 days, very often taking a train as far as they could go and stopping to do a little work and getting some money to go further. So that very often the top floor at this big old house, which had 3 rooms and which children slept, very often we would be hustled out of our beds late at night to make room for a family which didn't have anywhere to go and was passing through town. One night I was sleeping in a room next to where these people slept with an uncle. Woke up hearing the most extraordinary moaning and groaning. And it sounded so strange, and then all of a sudden I began to smell gas. So I ran down to the floor beneath and knocked on my grandfather's door, and he said to me, "My God, there's gas." And he said, "Get everybody out of here." And he went upstairs, and the family had been overcome by gas, because these poor people from the south who had been used before they went to bed to just take the shade off an oil lamp and blow it out, had seen gas for the first time, and they simply took the shade off and blew the gas out and into bed. And it was for me a very traumatic experience, and I think one of my earliest interests in trying to recognize the need to help people and to be concerned about people sprang from that unfortunate experience, because some of them were in the hospital 2 or 3 days before they could be released. Fortunately, nobody died. Some of the younger children were in very serious trouble. But these are some of the things I remember from my childhood. I remember that every summer my grandmother with some of the teachers organized at a little park in the black area of town, which was just a square near the railway track, but had very beautiful old trees and a lot of grass. And they organized Sunday summer Bible schools every morning. And I think some of my Jewish friends often say to me that I know more about the first five books of the Bible than they do, because we were really drilled in the history of the Jews. And largely because my grandmother was thoroughly convinced that when it came to matters of the liberation of black people, that we had much more to learn from the Jewish experience than we had to learn out of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So that I learned it. And it has stood me in very great stead, and I'm very thankful that sometimes when I didn't really want to read and learn the Psalms and the catechisms and other things I was required to do, as is so often the case, years and years later you look back and realize what a godsend it was that they insisted on. So that I got a very real grounding in the biblical stories and the application that they made to the life and experience. On the other hand, life was not all a bowl of cherries in terms of learning, because I can remember when I was in fifth grade, there was one Chinese family in town, and they they had a laundry. And I cannot account for how it happened, but I remember that a group of us went, all white except me, to this Chinese laundry and threw open the door and threw pebbles in and began to chant something that the kids taught me. Chink, chink, Chinaman, eat dead rats, hit him in the head with a baseball bat. Now, how that ever occurred to me to do such a thing, because when I got home, my grandmother, who never struck us, but she had heard about this, because the Chinese man came to my grandfather and told him that I was one of these who did this. And I got my first real opportunity to work outside the home for nothing, because I was assigned to go up there and help them wash clothes for 2 solid weeks after school. And I was very happy years later that I had been forced to do that, because it impressed upon me how important peers can be. Even when they're doing the wrong thing, you sometimes feel it's very important to stay with the gang, because I knew it was wrong to do. But I've never forgotten that little verse, although I only used it on that one occasion, but I've never forgotten it, or my grandmother's reaction to how I could have done such a thing. Did you?
Thank you. You mentioned that.
You want sugar or anything?
No, this is fine. Thank you. You mentioned that the schools were segregated up to high school.
Yes.
How did you feel when you entered high school then?
Well, it is a strange thing, because although the school was segregated, it was a very progressive school system in which there was no such thing as a teacher. I went to something called the Gay Street School, which was an eight a school with 8 grades, but with 12 classrooms. And there was, even at this point, and this was back in the very early 20s, there was specialization, so that half my teachers were white. That is, Mr. Hart, who was the music teacher, came one day a week and taught music. There was an athletic director for the whole school system, and he came one day a week to our school. So that I did not think of it as a segregated school, because I had white teachers. Also, because on given days, a given number of youngsters in the first grade or second grade or third grade would go to the public library for storytelling, and that made it interracial. Also, because the Westchester Normal School, which became Westchester College later, and is now known as Westchester State College, had a very fine concert hall. And Samuel Barber, the composer, who lived across the street from the college, his father, largely because of Sam Barber's own interest in music, and because his aunt was Madame Homer, who sang with Caruso, through Madame Homer and Sam's father, all kinds of artists came to the college. And because Leopold Sikorsky was the director of the Philadelphia Orchestra and interested in young people, he would very often bring ensembles of the Philadelphia Orchestra, a string quartet or something, and he'd give a lecture. And those things were interracial. And therefore, those first 8 years of my schooling, I must say, were in a segregated school, in that most of the pupils were black, but with so many outside activities in which whites were involved that it never occurred to me. Now, I never thought about the school as being segregated, but very early I thought about the theaters as being segregated, because I always had white friends even at that period, because there were whites living in my neighborhood, and my two best friends were Italian. But when I went to the movies, I always had to sit over on a side where there were just two rows of seats running the whole length of the theater, and they could sit where they wanted. And that's when I began to notice there was something wrong. Or when we went into the 5 and 10 at lunchtime, occasionally to pick up something, and I would see white kids sitting at the counter, but if I went to the counter for something, they wanted me to pack it up and take it out. Or the YMCA. Since I was involved in all kinds of sports, there would often be the teams of the high school, for example, would go over to the YMCA for extra practice in the winter time. Well, I wasn't allowed to go. And it was in high school that it was when I got to the integrated high school that what segregation was began to bear down upon me, because although going to school with the white boys and girls every day and being very well liked by them, and I must say very popular with them, when we left the school for any activity, that is when the segregation and discrimination appeared.
Well, would you say that up to that time you were not aware of the type of segregation and discrimination that existed in the South?
In the South, yes. Because I think if I were to think of two words that were rather elegant words, I mean in the sense that they were long and fell upon the tongue with some interest, were the words segregation and discrimination. Those, but this was somewhat removed and non-concretized because there were discussions my grandmother would have with me about lynching, but nobody in our neighborhood ever got lynched, you see. It was about blacks being beaten because they talked with a white woman, but nobody in my neighborhood could not talk to a white woman. So that while, well, at that period also, my grandmother, who was very much involved with the NAACP, a man like W.E.B. Du Bois, when he came to make a lecture at the college, obviously would stay with us because there was no black hotel. And James Weldon Johnson, I can remember coming. I can remember Mary McLeod Bethune as a considerably young woman coming to town to raise money for Bethune-Cookman College and staying at our house. So that I heard these discussions, but it was in a sense unreal to me because it was not within my experience. When I got to high school, then it began to really dig in. So it's ironic that as I went to a segregated school, I didn't feel it, but when I went to a integrated high school, I began to feel it, and a part of that was that at that time I was past the age of puberty, and the question always meant that blacks and white youngsters could play together until they reached the age of puberty, and then it became dangerous.
And well, you could talk to a white woman. Could you do that with a white girl at school?
Oh, sir. Yeah. In fact, at high school, the two girls that I spent most time with were both white. And the two young men, the four young men that I spent most time with, two were black and two were white. Now the reason I spent most time with the blacks is that they were on the various teams. I was on the football team, which was a championship team. In fact, there was a young man in here from my high school the other day interviewing me, and he tells me that the 1930 relay team award that we won at the Penn Relays is still what's the word?
The record
still stands. Here's the young white fellow that's in here. Now, the reason I was so close to these two black boys at high school was that one of them was on my track team and one was on my football team. And the reason I was so close to these two white girls is that there was a woman whose name was Miss Swadner, S-W-A-D-N-E-R, and Miss Swadner brought a very unique thing into that high school. She selected about 16 of what she called top students, segregated them so that we were together constantly. That is, except for extracurricular activities, we were in the same Latin class, the same Greek class, the same English class, the same mathematics class, and she was our home teacher. And this was before the days of home teachers, generally. So we were together so much, and these girls were very bright and very interested in poetry, as I was, and very interested in writing. So that not because of color, but because of a mutual interest, they became my best friends. And then another boy in that class was John Cessna, a young French boy, C-E-S-S-N-A. And so these two blacks, John Cessna and a Jewish boy whose name was Barney Hool, H-O-O-L, the only time I've ever heard a Jew with such a name. Barney I've heard in the Jewish community, but who I've never heard. At any rate, those were my friends in high school, very interracial. But when John Cessna, who was also a better runner than I was, and on our relay team, when they would not let me come into the Y to practice in the winter time, John refused to go to the Y, and therefore, in one sense, I think the first direct protest a la Martin Luther King that I ever saw was not on the part of a black, but on the part of John Cessna, who sat in on the director of the YMCA until he would at least come and give me an explanation. And I thought years later, the poor man, it was not that he was anti-black and didn't want to give me an explanation. He was so bloody embarrassed that when I walked in, the man asked to be excused. And I did not have any idea until he came back and I saw how red his eyes were, that he was so sensitive to have to explain this to me that he had gone out and cried. Very interesting. So John and I used to meet because our house was usually so busy with so many people moving around, and John Cessna, who was in one sense my very best male friend, his aunt with whom he lived would not countenance my coming into their house. So we used to meet in the public library every night from about 6:30 after we'd eaten our supper, and we'd study together until 8:45 when the library closed. And actually a lot of the kids at school used to refer to us behind our back as Whitey and Blackie. And I often think about that now, because at that time I think most Negroes would have been offended to have been called black, and now they'd only be called anything else. How times change. Well, those are some of the things I remember, but there is one other thing that I think is vitally important. In this segregated grade school, there was a woman whose name was Helena, H-E-L-E-N-A, Robinson. She was a Baha'i. And I had never heard of a Baha'i until I met her. She was a black woman. And she later became quite important in the Philadelphia Baha'i movement. But it was she who introduced all students in that segregated school to black history. And there was a woman whose name was Jessie Fawcett. Now Jessie Fawcett was a black writer. She wrote a number of novels about blacks at that time in the 20s. And she had a brother whose name was Arthur Huff. Boston. And Miss Robinson introduced to all students there in usually after school lectures the works of Arthur Huff Fawcett, which told the history of all the heroic blacks. And so very early I learned about the Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, W.B. Du Bois, did I say Booker T. Washington, etc. And she taught us in a creative and inclusive rather than exclusive way. The the importance of knowing something about our background in history. But because she was a Baha'i and did not believe in concentrating on the negative things, she told us about how awful slavery was, but her emphasis was always, but here are some of the fine things that white people did. So that she emphasized not slavery so much as the abolitionist movement. She would emphasize the fact that slaves had taught themselves, or that Quakers had gone to jail, white Quakers teaching black slaves to read and write. So that we didn't get the just negative aspects. She was very careful to see that we got a balanced picture in which whites were not looked upon as monsters, or blacks looked upon as all fine people. For example, there was a black whose name was Kincaid, and he is the one, as you probably may have heard, who led a slave revolt at sea. He was apprehended and brought into Boston Harbor, and there was a great trial in Boston, and he was freed and allowed to go back to Africa. Now, she taught us that, but she also taught us something else that most blacks today will not even recognize. And if you bring it up, they don't want to hear it. And that is that poor Kincaid, out of his experience, didn't learn very much because he went back to Africa and started a slave trade of his own. It's very interesting. And when I tell a number of blacks today who have Kincaid's picture in their homes that story, they simply don't want to believe it. And I say, well, go to the library and look it up. But they cannot face discovering that one of their heroes, you know. She also was very honest because she taught us that when the black slaves left America and went back to establish Sierra Leone, and what's the other one? Liberia, that at the time she was teaching us, it changed about 1932, but at the time she was teaching us, no one could be a member of the legislature of Liberia unless he was a descendant of an American slave. In other words, she taught me scholarship, that if you were going to look at a thing like slavery, look at the whole of it. Don't emphasize just the good parts. If you want to look at Kincaid, look at the whole of it. If you want to look at Thomas Jefferson, look at the whole of him. And she taught us that you know, that Jefferson had had slaves. and then would teach us what he then did about it. And therefore we got a better education about what the founding fathers were for Miss Robinson than I think anybody would get or even gets today in the schools, because she was so eminently honest that she had to tell us they had slaves, but she also had to tell us what they did about manumitting them, what they did about sending some of their illegitimate children to Paris to study, etc., etc.
You made reference to the abolitionist movement. Did she also teach you details or bring out details of the Underground Railroad?
Yes, not only that, but she took us, she taught the Underground Railway in a very creative way. There were great numbers of old Quaker houses in that neighborhood which still had the hidden areas in, and the hidden rooms and the cellars dug out. So what she did was to take us to those places and show us. Then she would come back and describe the nature of the Underground Railway. And Chester County, which is Westchester was in, was a very real center again, because it was between major cities. And people coming out of Baltimore or Wilmington up that route would very often just make it in a day of 18-mile walking to a place like Westchester, where they'd be put up and for the night, or kept a couple of days until they got rested up, and then taken a little further north to another place. So I was born in a very good spot for getting a picture of the Underground Railway.
And it seems to be implicit in what you've said, but wouldn't the fact that the Quakers were so involved and there was a Quaker concentration there be something of a magnet to these migrating?
Oh yes, definitely, because the Quakers, even Quakers who were not necessarily abolitionist, were thought to be by the slaves, because the word would be passed along. You may not be able to trust them all, but you can probably trust the Quaker. That was the general feeling.
Let me come back to the this later migration. I believe you said that was right after World War I.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the fact that that your own family, or the extended family that you lived with, was not well off, really. But were the new migrants coming in still poor?
Poor?
Poorer than
they were very
most of you
poor.
Were.
They were very poor. And there were, the reason for this, you see, before the war, it's important to remember that the objective was to keep these poor blacks on the land. And before the war, at the railway stations and at certain points on the roads, whites would come with their shotguns if blacks were trying to leave the South. After the war, when the machines were coming into the fields to do the work that they had done, very often they put shotguns to the back and told them to get the hell out. So they were not only poor, very often they left with only the clothes they had on their back. Depending on white people of goodwill to help them, on black ministers and church congregations to help them, on families who had come north. And somebody would say, well, I can make it as far as Westchester, Pennsylvania. If you can make it that far, we'll take you on the rest of the way. And so they came up the seaboard like this. Then there was another group which came up out of Louisiana and Alabama. And they usually headed not for New York, but for Chicago and Detroit. You get the picture? Those were the two main routes of the migration. Now, it was exactly about a few years earlier when the migration had begun, around the 1900, there was a movement out. This is before the war, of course. And it was in 1910 that the Urban League was founded. And the Urban League was exactly what it sounds like. It was a league, exactly what it sounds like. It was a league of people who were urbanizing these poor people who came from the fields. They would pee out the window, or they would dump trash out the window, or they didn't know what a bathtub was, or they would think that the toilet was the place where you wash clothes. I mean, they really were very, very unfamiliar, and the experience I told you. They would just blow out a gas lamp because that's what they had done. So urbanizing these people was a very serious matter.
We'll come back to the evolution of the Urban League later, mm-hmm. but just to put in here as a footnote, that particular mission of the Urban League after its founding was quite a bit different than it became in more recent years. Or
oh, decades. Yes. But that's what it was set up for. Mm-hmm. If it was set up now, I doubt it would be called an Urban League. but that is true of almost all organizations, that they changed their character. There was a time when the fundamental objective of the NAACP was to get rid of lynching. And it's interesting, the NAACP never got an anti-lynch bill through. But the propaganda around attempting to get it did the job. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Yeah, it's a footnote remark. It's somewhat analogous, is it not, to the impact of trying to get an Equal Rights Amendment passed.
Yes, exactly.
Women.
The fact of the matter is, although I'm not going to say it publicly, I don't really think now there is much of a need for an equal rights amendment. But since women want it, I want it because it makes them feel that they have something on which they can depend. But by the time they get it, there will be equal pay. And I'm pretty sure before they can get the amendment, many of the things they want. I think that the election of Reagan and the new trend means that it'll be quite a long time now before they can get it.
You mentioned some of the blacks that returned to Africa. What did you learn about the Marcus Garvey movement, or observe about the Marcus Garvey movement?
Well, my family were always integrationists. They were members of the NAACP. Although they were not associated with the Urban League, they knew about it, knew what it was doing, and in fact helped to do in our local community what the Urban League was doing in the communities where it existed. And therefore, our family were very, very much against Marcus Garvey. They felt that he had no real economic and social program. They felt that it would be a catastrophe for blacks to go back to Africa. And one of the reasons my grandmother was so against Garvey is that 15 miles from my home is Lincoln University. Now, if you know anything about Lincoln University, you will know that that is where great numbers of Africans came to be educated, including Ezekwe, including Nkrumah, who founded Ghana, Ezekwe, who was the father of the independence of Nigeria, and scores of other African students. In fact, many of these people, including Ezekwe, used to come to our house to parties. And what my grandmother had discovered was the feeling that many of the Africans who came over here for study had a superior attitude to American blacks. And she was deeply unhappy about these students from Lincoln who felt that they were in some way superior to American blacks.
At this period that you're talking about, was the, if I'm using the right term, the sort of sub-ethnic factionalism here, evident as between native-born, American-born blacks and the West Indian immigrants?
Oh, yes. In fact, I told you about my mother setting up a second family.
Mm-hmm.
She married a man whose name was William John. He was a Jamaican. And many of the people in Westchester, when she would return later, were very unhappy because she had married a monkey chaser. And that's what they call West Indians. They were supposed to be uncivilized. They were supposed to be too ambitious. They were supposed to be arrogant. And what people meant was that they had much more get up and go for going into business. And it embarrassed black Americans. Their language was different. Their attitude to women was much more domination. As I said, they had this business sense. And it was a very real feeling that, in addition to everything else, what is this monkey chaser coming over from Jamaica? This monkey chaser coming over from Jamaica telling us blacks to go back to Africa, why doesn't he go back to Jamaica?
You were describing the attitude of American blacks toward the West Indians. Was the feeling reciprocated on the part of the West Indians toward the American blacks, American-born blacks?
I think the West Indians are very proud people. And their sense of pride stimulated in the minds of black Americans arrogance. They had been freed from slavery earlier than we had. The British had always encouraged them to go into small business. The British colonialists did not want to sit around in rum shops selling rum and staples, wherein in the South the sharecroppers had to buy their food from the master's store, and he exploited them. They never had a chance to go into business. So that if you will look around Harlem today at what is left, most of the business people who are black, up until a few years ago,
125th Street were West Indians. Brooklyn today, most of the blacks. And this was resented. Now naturally, as you would know, if those people resent me, for whatever reason, I'm then going to resent them. But I really think the basic problem was with American blacks. Or let me put it this way, my perception as a youngster was that it was our problem, not theirs.
I'd like to come back just for a moment to your discussion of your various good friends. Did you ever sense that some of their parents might not have been wholly in favor of your close associations together?
I not only sensed it, I knew it. John Cessna and I, as I have said, he was the anchor man on our relay team because he was a 100-yard dash man. I was a 220 man. And he was the anchor man. He was the fastest guy in the school. He and I would discuss. And I would say to him, well, if I understand your aunt, because if she has prejudice, then she doesn't want me to come. But my mother doesn't have any prejudice, so you can come to our house if you want. And he said, no, because then my aunt will find out I'm going to your house and she will be angry with me. So let us go to the public library. We discussed it quite openly. And I think we were both convinced that neither of us had it, and we had no control over his aunt. And I think he was very respectful of my mother whenever he met her, and would always say, how do you do, Mrs. Rustin? How are you? And I gathered from his extreme politeness to her that he really admired her, largely because when he compared her with the woman with whom he lived, who was his old aunt, that he really felt that Ma Rustin was without feeling against people.
What about the Italian parents?
The Italians were themselves two things. First of all, they were Italians, which was not particularly appreciated in the town, even though they ran businesses. Second of all, they were Catholic in a town where there were a few Catholics. And I remember in 1928, the attitude in that town for anybody who supported Al Smith was simply unbelievable. So that my grandfather, being very close to the richest Italian, I think the Italians in our neighborhood sort of looked upon the Rustins as a little different from most of the blacks who lived on the other side of town. I think they appreciated it. Mrs. DeMundo was very close and was always sending tomato mash or spaghetti, or if anybody was sick in the family, she'd bring over a meal and tell my grandmother, don't cook, I'll do it. It was a real camaraderie.
You've mentioned your Jewish acquaintances here.
Yes.
But when, if you recall, when did you become fully aware of the extent of anti-Semitism in your area or the country?
Yeah, I became fully aware because a young Jewish friend of mine in 1928 asked me if I would go with him to hand out leaflets supporting and buttons supporting Al Smith. And he said, let's start over by the country club and work back toward town. The country club is on the outskirts, as they always are, in a beautiful grassy park. And the famous American writer, Hergesheimer, had a place just across from the country club. And the senator from Pennsylvania, whose name was T. Larry Ayer, E-Y-R-E, Senator Ayer, lived there. And we invaded that country, which was highly Episcopalian and Baptist. And naturally, we were terribly abused. But what made me so aware of anti-Semitism was that wherein they simply looked on me as being under his tutelage, which in part I was. Nobody spit at me or spit on me or called me a bastard, but they did him. That was when I discovered that that very often Jews were treated even worse than blacks. And that was in the Al Smith campaign in 28.
You mentioned your mother's discussing lynching and beatings in the South. When do you recall that you became aware of the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, it seems as if I have always known the word Ku Klux Klan. It's like the word discrimination, segregation, Ku Klux Klan. These are things that as children you heard parents discussing, or there would be a lynching in the paper, and you would hear them discussing it. And my grandmother never tried to keep these things from us, but she never tried to put too much on our backs that we couldn't carry it either. But I think I was probably in the fifth grade and had not yet got in touch with Helena Robinson. That was the next year. And my grandmother was explaining what a lynching meant. And I can remember saying to her, and I'd heard lynching, but it never dawned on me what it really meant. And I said, well, Mama, do people really do that sort of thing? And she said, yes, I'm afraid they do. And I can remember going around asking some of the other children if they'd ever heard of lynching. And all of them had heard of it. It's interesting. But when you ask them, what is lynching? What happens when a man gets lynched? And they said, well, he gets killed. But they had no idea, really, you know. And so I presume that the first I really had of any idea of the brutality of lynching, that it just wasn't like shooting a man or the like, was from her description. And then when we got into Helena Robinson, she taught us a great deal about what lynching was, why it was, what the economic roots of it were, what the social roots of lynching were, the tremendous fear of white men and any association with white women, how the Ku Klux Klan came about. Actually, you know, the Ku Klux Klan was a kind it did not start out just as brutalizing blacks. That was the next phase.
It started out as a protection to whites against the number of the abuses of the Union Army, of carpetbaggers and the like who came into the South. It later became something which was very, very ugly, really. And then Ms. Robinson also taught us the basic fact that the Ku Klux Klan was a reactionary group, that they were fundamentalist religiously. She went into a really considerable background as to what this phenomenon was. But that was in the sixth grade, and I guess one is what, in the sixth grade, 12 or 13, isn't it? What?
Six, starts with six, yes.
I'd like to ask you a question of your awareness of certain code words or terms at the time you were growing up, and I might use just a very briefly an item of my own experience. When I was a boy, there were there was only a handful of black families in Great Falls, Montana.
Where was this?
Great Falls, Montana.
Oh, good God.
there were no black pupils in my grade schools, and only two or three when I went to high school. But as I grew up as a boy, I used to like to fish, and I'd still fish. But among us boys, the term then was nigger fishing.
Nigger?
I would use it, nigger fishing.
Uh-huh.
And I would use this term, not realizing at that age what it meant. I certainly stopped using it later on. Were there such terms in currency as you grew up that kind of helped institutionalize discrimination?
Well, there was, the term nigger was more used in Westchester within the black community than outside. If someone was misbehaving, the kids would say, "No wonder they call you a nigger." Or, "Don't act like a nigger." Or if you were raising your voice when it was unnecessary, or being unfair. Now, it's interesting how often minority groups adopt the language which is used derogatorily to describe them and use it themselves. And on the other hand, if somebody on the football field, and not one of the players, but at a game, said, "Get that nigger," or something like that, then all the blacks were ready to fight. But there was very little name calling in Westchester, largely because the school was very careful in attempting to integrate in the high school. But I would say, quite honestly, I cannot remember a single incident of name calling. I've heard it on the football field, but those were from people who didn't go to high school. So basically, I think the institutionalizing was sitting on the side of one theater, sitting upstairs in another, not being able to get food at restaurants, not daring to go into the toilets in the center of town, but feeling you had to go home to go to the toilet where the white kids would go into the restaurants to go, or the shops. and we knew that we were not welcome there. Now, when it came to the teachers' college, there was absolutely no discrimination there at all in all of the cultural activities. So I think my experience was somewhat unique. I really do.
Well, you just mentioned teachers' college. Why don't we move on to your next stage of education?
Yes.
Where did...
When I left Westchester, I had no money to go to college, but there was a bishop in Philadelphia of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. He came from a very famous family, Wright family, W-R-I-G-H-T. And the Citizens and Southern Bank on South Street in Philadelphia was owned by the father of Bishop Wright. And Bishop Wright, largely because I had won the speaking contest at the school, I had delivered the valedictorian address. I was a soloist. I was probably the most important young man in the school, all of these things. He heard about it and came to see my grandmother and said I should go to college. And she said she thought that was the case, but there simply was no money. So he said that he would get a scholarship for me, and this shows the difference between then and now. I got $100 in scholarship money, went all the way to Ohio, to Wilberforce University, spent 2 years there, then came from there to this Cheney, C-H-E-Y-N-E-Y, teacher's college in Pennsylvania, spent 2 years there, then came to live with my sister, who was really my aunt, Bessie, in Harlem, and spent an additional 2.5 years at City College, and did it all on my own, of working. And I worked in a number of ways. One thing, there was a very famous singer whose name was Josh White, who sang in Cafe Society downtown and a number of other places. I joined a quartet which he had to back himself up with his music. And I made enough money to get through City College, not to get through because I'd never graduated, but to stay in City College for 2.5 years. Lead Belly was also a very famous singer who was in Cafe Society at that time. They had two of them, one called Cafe Society Downtown in Greenwich Village, and one Cafe Society Uptown in the 50s. Mary Lou Williams, the famous pianist, jazz pianist, was also there. Art Tatum, another jazz pianist. Do you ever hear of Art Tatum? Great guy. They used to say he tickled the keys. At any rate, that's how I stayed in City College. Now, at Wilberforce, I finally left there because the food was very bad. And I organized a strike to improve the food. Well, as a scholarship student, I should have known that if I organized a strike to improve the food, that I was going to be asked to leave, which they did. I am in a sense glad they did, because the school did not stretch me. I sang in the choir and quartet and traveled all over the country making money for the school. But there was really no academic challenge to the place for me. And so when they asked me to leave, I decided it was a very good thing, and I left. Then I went on to Pennsylvania, back to the Teachers College. And here again, I did not really find the school challenging. Then I decided, since my sister, Bessie, wanted me to come to New York, I decided to come to New York and went to City College. Now, when I got to City College,
it was the time of the Scottsboro case, the time when all kinds of atrocious things were happening to blacks in the South. It was a time when Roosevelt was beginning to bring about economic and social programs that were helping the unemployed and the like. But Roosevelt never had a program to do anything about civil rights per se. In fact, he tried to stay as far away from it as he could. I'll get into that later when sometime we're talking about my work with A. Philip Randolph in getting the two executive orders, first one to Roosevelt, but we'll not go into that at this time.
Yes, that was during World War II, wasn't it?
Just before.
Mm-hmm. Or during mobilization.
1941, early 40, 41. What was I going to go into? Oh, when I was at City College, I discovered that the Norman Thomas socialists were taking the view that civil rights is important, but you don't do something to help blacks by concentrating on civil rights. You change the economy to a socialist economy, and automatically blacks will get their rights. Well, I was watching what was, and I didn't want to wait. I was impatient. And then I ran into, at City College, a number of young, radical whites and blacks who were members of the Communist League. And I joined the Communist League. And one of the reasons that I did not really do much studying those 2.5 years I was at City College was because I was really organizing all over the state of New York for the Young Communist Party, Young Communist League, it was called. And I learned many of the most important things I learned about organization and clearing detail and writing clearly and the like from my experience with the communists. Now, at some point when there's time, I will tell you why I broke with the communists and the like. But I was deeply concerned to believe that Roosevelt was not interested in ordinary people, that everything he was doing was really to preserve the capitalist class. I was reading Marx and Bakunin and Lenin and the memorizing the Communist Manifesto and reading Strachey, the British socialist. And
had pretty much come to feel that if blacks were going to get anywhere, then they had to associate themselves with something more radical than the Democratic Party. We were getting close to a feeling that many young people had that we were probably going to go into war before too long, and that the only group that could save us from war would be the communists. I was very naive at that point, but that's what I believed at that point. And consequently, the major role I had at City College was to organize the radical elements on the campuses, help set up and take over the American Student Association. And working with the communist elements in the CIL and the trade union movement, etc. Would you excuse me just a minute?
You were discussing your organizing activities.
Yes.
Communist organizing activities within these other organizations, labor, student association, and so forth.
Yeah. Well, the objective, of course, was to radicalize students, to get them protesting any problems of civil liberties. One of the main cases that we had was a teacher at City College. His name was Shappies. Do you remember the Shappies case? S-H-A-P-P-E-S, Shappies. That was typical. Shappies was accused of being a communist, and they made an effort to dismiss him. And there was a lot of that kind of thing going on at that time. And, of course, we welcomed that. There was the whole propaganda against Roosevelt, and the fact that Roosevelt was trying to deal with the economic problems which he faced by going to war and solving the economic problems. And there was a great deal of discussion about that. By the way, I'm going to need to finish up here in the next 10 minutes. Is that all right?
That's fine.
So that, as I said, I think that as I look back upon it, I learned a great deal in that period, and a good bit of that stood me in good stead when I was later working with Mr. Randolph and Dr. King from a totally different political orientation, but in the civil rights and in fact in the human rights field. So although I think the experience was, well, I'm happy I had it. It taught me a great deal. And I presume if I had to do it over again, I'd do the same thing.
Did you find a fairly, a relatively widespread receptivity to your ideas during that time?
Not terribly widespread, but a sufficient number of young people so that we were able to build, I suppose, 25 or 30 cells in colleges around the country.
Around the whole country.
Around New York, yes. The city colleges in New York were, of course, the mainstay, the radical mainstay. At that point, it may interest you to know that the City College in New York, where the dining rooms now are, up on the uptown campus, were alcoves at that time in this enormous room, and each alcove was about the size of this room, or maybe a little more narrow, about this size. And the university assigned those alcoves to the various political parties. The Norman Thomas Socialists had one, the Trotskyists had another, the Leons had another, the Blacks under the name of the Maroi Society, which was a black club, they had one. It wasn't the same kind of black clubs you have now. This was a social fair kind of club. And then the communists had their alcove. And these were actually assigned by the dean of the college for the activities of the young students. And we managed to take over the City College newspaper. And we managed to control the Student Senate. And we managed to control the budget for how the money was to be spent amongst the various student organizations. And we began the propaganda against Roosevelt and the war, which we said was definitely coming. That was going to be Roosevelt's war. And we had a song which will interest you. When the conscription bill came up, we composed the song. It was on a Saturday night, and the stars were shining bright, and they passed the conscription bill. And the people, they did say, for many miles away, it's the president and his boys on Capitol Hill, of course. Oh, I hate war, and so does Eleanor, but we won't be safe till everybody's dead. There were several stanzas to that, and that became probably the most popular anti-war song prior to World War II that was ever sung. It was just sung on the campuses whenever you walk in. And say, I hate war, and so does Eleanor, but we won't be safe till everybody's dead. And this was a time when Joss White and Woody Guthrie were singing for all the radical causes. And what's his name, the old man? Oh. Yes. Pete Seeger, one of the great heroes, of course, at this time was Paul Robeson. One of the great songs we used to sell on records was What Does America Mean to Me, you know that record? And we stocked it up and were selling it all over the place. We were definitely a thorn in the side of the administration, and then unfortunately they had a Quaker who was the president of the college, Dr. Wright, and he was all the more shocked because of my Quaker background that I would behave in any such manner.
When you, just to clarify one date here, or period, when you were making these references to the Conscription Act and to World War II, were you speaking more specifically to our, before we got involved in World War II, but the war was on in Europe?
Yes.
Because that was 39.
This was 39.
Yes.
As you remember, in 39 the war was on in Europe, mm-hmm. except there wasn't any war.
They called it the Phony War.
The Phony War. And we were convinced that this was simply a process, that's all right. This was simply a process by which Churchill and company were trying to get America in, and the phrase we use, once more to take the British chestnuts out of the fire. And there was, now this was an interesting thing, that all the surveys showed that the Congress was unalterably opposed to the conscription bill. But when the showdown came, only one congressman in the House voted against it, and that was Adam Clayton Powell. And of course, one of the reasons that Adam voted against it was because at that point, he was very close to the Communist Party. And if you remember, the communist Benjamin Davis, who took over in the City Council of New York, took Adam's seat there. Adam put his blessing upon him, even though he was known and admitted that he was a communist.
And I'm not sure that my dates are correct here, but was Mark Antonio in the Congress at that time?
Mark Antonio was in the Congress. In fact, one of the things we at City College did was every Saturday morning, we used to organize 15 or 20 kids to go over to Mark Antonio's place in East Harlem. And we had desks in this big room, and Mark Antonio's constituents would line up outside, and he would greet them and talk to them, and then he'd send them to various ones of us to deal with their problem. That was one of the great aspects, and one of the reasons Mark Antonio, although pretty much known as a fellow traveler, was so greatly appreciated and elected time after time, was because he set up this great apparatus for listening to the ills of the predominantly, at that time, Italian population.